Christina Lake Cannabis is using proprietary outdoor genetics to grow and harvest cannabis in Western Canada. And with a 99-acre expansion, production should increase from nearly 72,000 pounds to a harvest capacity of over 194,000 pounds of high-quality, refined cannabis to extract exceptional THC and CBD oils. This cannabis highlight has been brought to you by Christina Lake Cannabis, U.S. trading symbol CLCFF and the Canada CLC. ChristinaLakeCannabis.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. It's a great pleasure to welcome Holly Fretwell of the Property, Environment, and Research Center, PERC, of Bozeman, Montana. Recently, Holly and her colleague Jonathan Wood have published a new guide to American forests. It's entitled Fix America's Forests, Reforms to Restore National Forests and Tackle the Wildfire Crisis. Wildfire Crisis, Holly, congratulations and good evening. Wildfire crisis is vaguely appropriate to the scale of this. In California in 2020, I covered these fires. They ranged right up to the edge and into the wealthiest parts of the state and also the most remote and beautiful parts of the state. The statistics say 9,600 fires burned 4.4 million acres, 4% of the state's roughly 100 million acres in California alone. You're describing something much more vast. These wildfires, do they weigh on the states where they range across, or do people shrug and say, business as usual, we live out west? Good evening to you, Holly.
Good evening, and thank you so much for inviting me, John. For sure, people feel these fires heavily, heavily when they come across the landscape. And even if it's not in your own state but another state, we are often suffering the smoke that's coming from other states. California fires, Idaho fires, we feel those here in Montana. And we had a number of fires here in Montana last year, one right in our backyard that took out 28 homes.
And these fires, I thought they're part of nature. You know, you read about Native Americans who had forest fires and they dealt with it. I thought it was part of nature, but it turns out, I learned from your book, it's not part of nature. There are federal lands, the number I have is vast, federal lands, 193 million acres of federal lands, and in those 193 million, you've identified 80 million that need attention. What kind of attention, Holly?
Well, they need some attention for restoration, but to be fair, fire is an inherent part of the forest, and it's a really important part. But we have managed our forest in such a way for the last 100 years that the fires that we see in many of our forests now, particularly on our federal lands, are just much more intense, they're much more severe, they're hotter, they're longer, they're more damaging. And we also have a number of people that are living along the edge of those federal lands, what we call the wild urban interface. And in that area, when these fires come in, they take out a lot of these homes. And so we need to do something, and we can do something. That's the point. We can actually manage fires. A healthy forest really is a human construct. We are the ones that define what is healthy and what is not healthy, and we are the ones that define what we want from our forest, and we can manage for that as well.
There are drivers for the wildfires that we have seen in the news these last years. What is the 10 a.m. rule? How does that work, Holly?
Well, the 10 a.m. rule is one that's been in effect for a very long time. And basically it says if the fire is continuing to burn, that we'll get out there at 10 a.m. to put that fire out. And one of the problems that we see is that we continue talking about suppressing the fires and putting the fires out, even though they are natural, and we're allowing those fires to take off instead of stepping back and years in advance, or at least a year in advance, let's start doing some restoration. We can do some forest restoration. We can remove some of the woody debris, some of the litter, as we call it, that's on the ground, that's the really flammable stuff, those pine needles and small twigs, et cetera, that actually get these fires to take off and to burn really hot. And once they get hot at the bottom, they just start to go up into the crown. And that's when we have some really serious problems. And again, we need to be fair. Some forests naturally burn that way, and some forests used to burn every 5 to 25 years. So those forest types that used to historically burn every 5 to 25 years are the ones that we really can do something to manage them by removing some of the small diameter timber and making them a more open landscape so that when that fire does get in, which is natural, it actually does drop to the ground and just burn that stuff on the floor instead of taking off and burning everything around it and then shooting out for acres and acres and acres and taking everything around in addition to emitting all that carbon into the atmosphere.
My reading of your book is that the drivers for these wildfires are man-made. These are man-made policies. And I want to explore those first because the solutions you have are rich, but we need to see how the policy got us into this place. The Forest Service over the last 30 years has evolved from a mix of foresters and experts and technicians to what becomes a fire company. It's dominated by firefighters. I don't believe that had to happen, Holly. Is that a product of the 10 a.m. rule? Did the forest fire fighting create the forest fires?
We have definitely created a lot of these forest fires by continuing to fight fires and reduce the amount of timber that we're harvesting from our forest. What we actually see in our federal forest, on the national forest today, is that there is more timber that is dying from mortality than is actually growing. And we continue to reduce harvest, which is making that problem even worse. And as a result of that, we're seeing some of these big, huge fires. We've also reduced the number of staff entirely with the Forest Service. And in addition to doing that, we've taken the number of people that are actually what we call silviculturists or engineers and foresters, and we've cut them in half. And at the same time, we've more than doubled the number of people that are fighting fire. So when we hear this line, you know, from the Forest Service to the Fire Service, that's one of the things that we're talking about. It's just the whole change in staffing and culture of the Forest Service and of the agency that's moving us away from this good restoration and timber management and into really just responding to these fires as they come to us more and more regularly each year.
Is the Forest Service aware of this transformation of the service into a fire company? Do they know about it? Do they talk about it?
Absolutely. They talk about it. When we were writing this report, we worked with a number of different folks from the agency trying to get a better understanding of what's really going on there. And they call it a cultural problem. And you can measure the staff numbers and the differences in the employees and what types of jobs they're doing. But it's harder to measure the actual sort of cultural impact that's going on. And what we see is it always goes all the way back to our education. And the education system for most people that are studying forests now, they're really studying ecosystem services and watersheds and wildlife habitat, and they're studying less and less the actual silvicultural dynamics, and that is, you know, actually what's happening in the forest. How do we use these timber products? How do we manage for timber and ecosystems and wildlife and watersheds, and really looking at that whole picture and getting an understanding of what these timber products can do for us if we actually remove them from the forest. So we're seeing less of that and much more just of the ecosystem type of management and interest, and that is part of this cultural problem that the Forest Service feels, and agency personnel for sure understand that and are trying to make some shifts with that and trying to get better inventory of what's actually happening in the forest so that we can get a better understanding of what we can do with some of these products, especially some of the small diameter products that exist out there, that if we can remove them, we could add value. But right now, there's not a whole lot of certainty for some investor to come in and say, I'm going to build a mill because it's going to cost me $100 million. And if I'm not guaranteed or don't have a pretty good idea that the Forest Service is going to continue to provide me with this product, that raw material, then I'm probably not going to invest in that. So we have a lot of problems that are sort of stemming from the way the Forest Service has been managing in the last several decades.
Another driver, it occurs to me as an amateur reader, is that civilization is building deeper and deeper into the forest. And building into forests, and what I know is from California, I don't know if this applies to other states, building into the forest that itself, the forest itself, is not managed by the state or the federals to clean out that fuel. What you call the fuel in the forest sits there. People regard it as pristine, and the nature wants it, but doesn't. I think that's the driver for these large wildfires and why the public reaction is so severe. They're living in the only thing I can imagine is they're living in a tinderbox. Is that a fair metaphor?
I think that's a fair metaphor, that what we call the WUI, the wildland urban interface, is actually growing rapidly. And in the past 20 years, it has grown larger than the state of Texas. And what that means is we have more and more people that are moving along the fringe of the forest, where they are much more at risk because of wildfire, because they're sitting right there within the forest or on the edge of the forest. And most of us, if you look at a picture, we look at a picture of a healthy forest and we think of, well, maybe I should just back up a minute. When you think of a really healthy forest, is it this green, lush, really dense forest, or is it this sort of wide open forest where you could actually walk through the forest?
Teacher, I'm raising my hand. I know the answer. I've read your book. Okay. it's the wide open forest where you have fields in between the healthy trees. Is that the right answer, teacher?
That's the right answer for many of our forests. Again, there are different forest types, but for many of our forests, but that's not what most of us want to see and are used to seeing. And so when you move into this wildland urban interface and you have this beautiful dense forest behind you, it's really hard to get out there and cut those trees down because that doesn't look right. That doesn't look healthy. But that's exactly what we need to do. We need to clear a space behind, around our house. We need to clear spaces within the forest. And it's not just right next door. That certainly helps. But if we get a wildfire that's, you know, a mile away, it can send an ember into your house. That's how big these fires are getting and how much they can actually send that risk of burning down homes and burning down neighboring forests.
We've established that forest restoration is a wise course, not only for the people who live near the forest or in the forest, but also for the Forest Service itself, which has had reduced funding and increased demand because of these wildfires. So what is to be done? I'm speaking with Holly Fretwell. Holly and her colleague, Mr. Wood, Jonathan Wood, have published a new booklet from a new pamphlet from the Property Environmental Research Center, Jonathan Wood and Holly Fretwell, entitled Fix America's Forests. That's what we're going to do when we come back. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. Holly Fretwell and her colleague Jonathan Wood published Fix America's Forests, Reforms to Restore National Forests and Tackle the Wildfire Crisis, from the Property, Environment, and Research Center of Bozeman, Montana. We've established that we have drivers for creating wildfires, which get in the news. But more to the point, forests are not healthy that are dense. There are other contributing factors besides the sun and the water and Mother Nature. The first one is that there seem to be limitations on what you can and can't do with forests. I'm not exactly sure what all of this means, except for the fact that there are national laws that limit commonsensical forestry. Holly, you mentioned the one that is overwhelming, which is NEPA. What is NEPA? What does it mean for the forest?
NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act, and what NEPA does is it actually requires the agency to go through various steps and a process to ensure that the actions that they're doing are not going to have a major environmental impact, and that if they do, we've examined what that impact is, and we've accepted some of the different alternatives that we could actually think about. And so NEPA in and of itself is a fine law, and it's something that's really important. We want to make sure that when we're out there managing our forests or other federal lands, that we are considering the environmental impacts of those landscapes. What's interesting about NEPA is it also opens the door for red tape and litigation. And one of the things that we found as we were working through this report is that NEPA is much more problematic in some regions than it is in other regions. So if you're up here in Montana, it's what's called Region 1 for the Forest Service, we get the majority, we get something like 40% of all forest restoration projects that are litigated are here in my region, in Region 1. California, Region 5, gets about 30% of all the forest restoration cases that are litigated. And so then you split that up between the other seven regions, and they get a few here and there. So one of the things that we're still really looking into is why is it that we are getting so many different cases that are litigated, whether while other regions are not, because it becomes a really big problem for us here in Montana. And in fact, we have our water reservoir, which is just outside of Bozeman, Montana, and they have been trying to do a restoration project for 20 years, and it continues to get appealed, litigated, goes through the process. We have, you know, people inputting that public input process. It gets appealed again. We get through it. Something else comes up. We have another supplemental analysis that has to be done. All the while, this is our water reservoir. If we burn up there in the Highlight Reservoir, we are going to lose the majority of the water that is provided to Bozeman, Montana. We have about 3 days worth of water. 20 years in the process, millions and millions of dollars. Why can't we get through that? It's part of that NEPA process and part of that planning process that's holding this up. Again, in California, we seem to see things that are litigated continually as well. But in other regions, not so much. So we're doing some analysis to try to get a better handle of that. My guess is, just off the bat, Endangered Species Act is a part of this. We have a lot of endangered species in this region, so it gives litigious groups something to grab onto and say, no, you can't harvest there. We also have a number of groups here regionally that really just don't want any harvest to be done. They just don't think harvest should be done, and that's just a different mindset, right? But because of NEPA, they have the ability to hold a case and to postpone projects that are taking place. So NEPA is definitely a problem, but again, much more of a problem in some areas than in other areas.
I note that the southeast of the United States, the southern region, has one project litigated, one. So clearly there is a vast difference between the 54 of your region and the one of the south, and we'll discover it, because you mentioned the Endangered Species Act, but as I understand it, the Clean Air Act also inhibits commonsensical forestation, because it limits the burns. Is that what it does? It says you can't burn here, even though that's healthy for the forest?
That's exactly right. When we have try to do prescribed burns, which really help us reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfire and bring us sort of back down to that natural state that we'd like to see, you know, prescribed burns emit carbon and other particulate into the atmosphere. And as a result, those are calculated as part of each state's analogs of the Clean Air Act. And what we would like to see is some comparison here. Let's say, well, would we rather have that prescribed burn, or would we rather have the wildfire that's going to be sending an enormous amount of carbon, much, much more than a prescribed burn would be. But at this point, the wildfire is actually an exception, because it's something we can't, you know, we have no control over. So that is pulled out of the Clean Air Act, while the prescribed burn, which is trying to prevent that wildfire, is being calculated as part of that Clean Air Act emissions. And so that has been very problematic in most states. Each state is slightly different. And so, again, that is one of those areas that we think we could really make some change and see some increased restoration that will really help us reduce the wildfires that we see and those great emissions from those large wildfires.
I'm glad you mentioned that formula, because it occurred to me, again, as an amateur reader, the wildfires are a product of not burning the fuel in the forest. You burn the fuel in the forest, and the Clean Air Act objects to you filling the atmosphere of those homeowners who insist upon living in the pristine forest. And therefore, it limits your burn, how much you can do, when you can do, and that creates the fuel for wildfires. Have I got the formula right? It's a big circle, and it leads to the forest being left unhealthy and people being in danger.
It is a big circle, and we need to get people to understand a little bit more clearly as to what the problem is. And more people are understanding that, and the reason for that is because more and more people are living on the edge of wildfire, and their homes have burned, and they've seen other people whose homes have burned. They're seeing the smoke from wildfire, and they're starting to say, okay, I don't want that to happen in my neighborhood, and I really am willing to think a little bit more carefully now about how we can reduce that risk and reduce that severity of these fires that are coming through.
And so we have NEPA, Endangered Species Act, the Clean Air Act. I believe we could also bring in here water management, can't we? Because you say that a damaged forest creates erosion, which leads to a runoff in water and a completely reorganizing of how nature wants to live healthily. So not only do we have forests that are not being properly managed and being treated as if they're tinderboxes, but we have damage to the environment that the people who bring the litigation want to protect. Are they aware of this logic, Holly? Because we'll turn to your solutions, but when you present this matter to them, do they respond commonsensically, or do they stay with their litigation? We have 30 seconds here.
You know, some people just have different ideas as to what the forest should look like and really don't believe we should cut trees. And they are not willing to weigh the risk to individuals and to the rest of us in society that are being impacted by these great costs when we don't manage our forests more logically.
So they have a vision of a forest that doesn't actually exist, but it's wonderful. It's romantic. And that romantic vision cannot be replaced by the facts on the ground. So let's get to partnerships. The work from PERC, is Property Environment and Research Center, is entitled Fix America's Forests. Holly Fretwell and her colleague Jonathan Wood are the authors. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. It's a pleasure to speak with Holly Fretwell of the Property, Environment, and Research Center in Bozeman, Montana, where Glory lives. She and her colleague Jonathan Wood have published Fix America's Forests, Reforms to Restore National Forests and Tackle the Wildfire Crisis. If you know PERC and you've heard me talk to PERC over the years, you know that the way forward is a partnership between private enterprise and the national forests or the state forests. And what is to be done is to create those partnerships, and Holly and Jonathan have examples here. Holly, what is the National Forest Foundation, and how does it work in, say, northern Arizona and could work in southern Arizona? What does the model look like, Holly?
Well, the National Forest Foundation is a congressionally chartered nonprofit that actually takes revenues that the people are interested in donating to help manage the forest, revenues coming in from other areas, grant funds, et cetera, and then is able to pass those through to the Forest Service to get some of this work done. So they are sort of the catalyst to create some of these collaborative groups and bring them together to be able to work with the Forest Service. What we've seen in the northern Arizona is a great project that's been taking place to try to enhance restoration in the region. It's a collaboration with a number of different groups, the Salt River Project, who's a utility company, City of Phoenix, Scottsdale, Coca-Cola, Arizona Department of Fish and Wildlife, outdoor recreation groups, conservation groups, a whole bunch of different individuals that are interested in ensuring that we reduce the risk of wildfire and that we enhance the use of our forest, if you will, so that we can use it for both products, you know, wood products, for ecosystem services such as clean water, for recreation, for wildlife, etc. The agency itself does not have the funds to take care of this problem. And even if we dumped a ton more money into the National Forest and into the Forest Service and said, here, go do what you wish, that's not going to solve the problem for us. We still have this sort of political influence and political ramifications as to how the money is going to be spent. What we really see is through these collaborative groups and these local partnerships, those are the individuals that really understand the problem. Those are the individuals that are going to benefit most from doing good restoration, and they're the ones that are going to pay the cost from not doing that restoration. So these groups getting together, talking through what makes most sense is really bringing that great information from on the ground right there into the forest restoration process, and then bringing these individuals together so that we can actually get this stuff done. We talked about NEPA previously. Most of these projects, people are not interested in doing them until they are what we call shovel ready. And what that means is that it's already through the NEPA process, because that NEPA process can add additional time and risk to whether the project's actually going to take off. Once we get through that NEPA acceptance, then these collaborative groups can actually get in there, and they're making some great success in generating revenues. The Northern Arizona Project has raised something over $6 million to try to get this restoration done, again, with lots of different groups putting in to help make a difference and make sure that we have a good, healthy forest that's meeting the demands of the citizens that live near that forest.
What can go wrong and why? Let's go to the state of California, and the example is the Yuba Water Project. Yuba restoration bond for $4 million. And yet there's hesitation about bonds, or bonds need more support. How is it that the bonds haven't worked yet?
So Blue Forest Conservation has actually introduced an idea called the Forest Resilience Bond, and they have worked together with the Yuba Water Utility and several other groups, some private investors, some philanthropists, other locals, again, talking about the conservation groups and the wildlife groups in this region. And what they're trying to do is they were trying to figure out, how do we get this money up front so that we can actually do this work on the ground, do this restoration work, reduce the risk of severe wildfire. But we have to get the money up front, and then it's going to provide these benefits benefits over a long period of time. And they have actually been very successful at creating what they call the Forest Resilience Bond. And the investors and the water utility have put the money up front to help pay for this project. And then water users over time will be paying back that bond as they're realizing the benefits of clean water and clean air over time. So they have been very successful with it. They've actually just generated a new project, raising something like $6 million just recently to try to continue to expand this forest resilience project. One of the difficulties of taking that type of a project and doing it somewhere else is that what's happening in the Tahoe National Forest, which is where this project is taking place, there's a lot of valuable timber that exists in there. So they can put the money up front, get that restoration done, take that timber, sell it, also provide, you know, money from the water utilities users, and that's what paying back that bond. If you're looking in an area where there's really very little added value in the forest and in the products that we're removing, it becomes much more difficult to pay that back. Potentially in the future, we could see that being paid back because there's all kinds of uses for this small diameter timber. But in the California area, we have the mills in place that are taking that resource and adding value to it. If we're looking in Arizona and some other places where we have really small diameter timber, we don't always have the ability to add the value there. We need some significant investment, some private investment in mill infrastructure and processing plants, and we don't have that right now. So it's a harder model to follow across the board in every region.
I learned from Holly that in 2001, in addition to the war, Congress created the Good Neighbor Authority for the Forest Service. This was a positive idea to permit to enhance partnerships with states, with tribes, and with counties for forest management. However, what can go wrong and why? What we have here is the possibility that there are rules that will not bend. Are the rules left over from the 20th and the 19th century, Holly? Is that what the concern is?
You know, sometimes we get things passed and then we get it taken away, right? So some of the rules are really just part of the Farm Bill process where the authority was given for the Good Neighbor Authority, and just restrictions that sometimes don't make a lot of sense to one group, but maybe make more sense to another group. The Good Neighbor Authority has been wonderful to allow states to actually work with the federal agencies to get some of this restoration work done. The states have to then get some of that seed money up front to get these projects started. But once they are working on these projects, if it's done at the state level, the revenues that are generated there can go back into the state to continue the process and do additional projects over time. Unfortunately, what's happened with the counties and the tribes is that those revenues are not allowed to go back to the counties and the tribes. So what we would like to see is more flexibility so that those groups that are actually doing these projects can generate those revenues so they can continue the projects and sort of roll that money forward for the next project and the next project. Because again, as we get to these more local levels, these are the people that really understand some of the problems that exist here. And so those are the folks that have that good, solid information as to what are some of the best projects that we should be doing and what are some of the great benefits we can get out from them.
That's a model that works with wildlife as well as with forests. I see this the same thing. The people who live there have the most to gain from proper management of their environment, whether it's a buffalo or a forest. It seems very logical. Is that case made? Clearly, you mentioned the state of Idaho. Does the state of Idaho understand that the people who live next to the forest are the ones who are going to take care of it best, not us in the state capital?
The state of Idaho has done a great job with Good Neighbor Authority, and we're some of the leaders really getting some of this stuff at scale. And yes, they definitely understand that. And you know, we've talked with a number of different states that are looking at this, what we call this GNA program. And some of the states feel like the Fed is actually putting a load on them, putting the burden on them, but they understand how important it is to get this stuff done. So some states were sort of standoffish at first and did not want to be a part of this project because it really, I mean, these are federal lands, right? Maybe the feds should be taking care of their own land. But as this fire risk increases and individuals are realizing how dire the situation really is, some of these states are starting to come in and say, okay, look, we need to help get this done because the feds aren't getting it done, and we need to make some progress on this. And as a result of that, we're seeing more and more states starting to partake in this process, and they've also watched some of the other states and some of the lessons learned there as to how they can actually be really effective at doing this and that there are potential returns. Again, if you're talking about a forest that really doesn't have any timber, value that's been removed, it's much more difficult, because thinking about what those ecosystem services are and the, certainly provide huge value for clean water, clean air, recreation trails, et cetera, but those are harder to put a dollar amount on and harder to generate revenues from, and therefore it's harder to get that upfront funding to actually get that project taken care of.
Holly knows that I was at Bozeman, very happily, in Bozeman, Montana at PERC, the year that Idaho burned. At least that's the way it was presented to me, an Easterner who doesn't know anything. I looked up in the air one morning and it was all smoky, and I thought, well, what's happened here? And I wandered outside and the mountains were smoky, the forest was smoky. I thought, well, there's a fire somewhere, until somebody told me, no, it's just Idaho. Idaho! I'm in southern eastern Montana, and Idaho was on fire, which is a long way away. Holly, is that routine, that a state burns and everybody shrugs it off?
I don't think it's typical anymore, but for sure there are some states that get more attention than others and some fires that get more attention than others. And when things are on fire, depending upon which way the wind is blowing is depending upon where that smoke is going to go. So here in Montana, if we get that smoke, we probably don't get a whole lot of attention. I guarantee you, if you get it in California or Seattle or one of those larger metropolis areas, that you're going to get more concern and it's going to be heard a lot more across the nation.
What is to be done when we come back? Recommendations from Fix America's Forest by Holly Fretwell and her colleague Jonathan Wood, Property Environment and Research Center, Bozeman, Montana. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network. It's a great pleasure to speak to Holly Fretwell with her colleague Jonathan Wood, publishing Fix America's Forest, Reforms to Restore National Forests and Tackle the Wildfire Crisis. We've touched on these eight recommendations in part, but I want to go through them for Holly to explain more completely. Holly, you encourage collaboration. We've just talked about that, the Good Neighbor Act. Avoiding analysis paralysis. I like that. What does it mean, Holly?
Well, analysis paralysis is one of those terms, and like the Gordian knot that our former chief of the Forest Service, several of them have come up with, in the sense of there are so many layered regulations that overlap each other that make it really difficult to get anything done on the ground. We have the NEPA, we have the Clean Air Act, we have the Endangered Species Act, we have the National Forest Management Act, we have the Wilderness Act. All these different laws have to be abided by the agency, and by the time you get done trying to work your way through that, you're kind of tied in a knot, and that's where the Gordian knot comes from. But there are things that we can do to reduce that. And I think if you take all of our recommendations and you sum them up, what we're trying to say is, you know what, we really just need to lower the transaction costs so that we can actually get something done on the ground. And it's going to take some collaborative groups. It's going to take some public-private partnerships. And it's going to take the ability for the Forest Service to have more flexibility with their contracts so that they can be longer, so that they can meet the time that is necessary to get some investment in the infrastructure that we need in order to add some value to some of these small diameter products.
We've spoken of the litigation and the, what you'd have to say, odd combination of having a lot of forests and having a lot of litigation as compared to the southeast of the United States, which has wonderful, rich forests, but very little litigation. It's a puzzle we're not going to solve here. However, when it comes to the EPA or NEPA, the Clean Air Act and water, Holly, do we need larger and longer-term exclusions? Did I understand that word correctly?
Yeah, we have what's called categorical exclusions, which are actually under the National Environmental Policy Act, and they allow for the Forest Service or other federal agencies to actually do some projects that don't have big environmental impacts or that are not seen to have environmental impacts, but actually get them done without going through this long, drawn-out NEPA process. And what we would like to see is just slightly larger categorical exclusions, something that makes sense at the scale of wildfire. The recent NEPA planning rules, unfortunately, did not expand what forest restoration can do under categorical exclusions, and we feel like that's really, really necessary in order to get some of this stuff done and to get it done at the pace and scale that we need in order to protect some of our forest and those people living nearby and far, far away when we're thinking about the air.
The Endangered Species Act is keen on preserving what they understand of the species in the area. But it occurs to me that if you're going to do a controlled burn, do you have to go through the Endangered Species Act? That's That's illogical, because of course the species are going to be damaged with the burn. How can you help it? But you're trying to save the whole ecosystem, not just one part of it.
That's right. And that's one of the other things that we really want people to start considering, both at the legal side of things and just when we're looking at some of these planning and these processes. And that is, if we don't do anything, then we're likely to see the burn. And the burn is going to be much more damaging for the wildlife, for the water, for the air, for people living in the region. So let's start to think about, well, we might have some environmental damage if we do this restoration, but in the long run, that damage is going to be much, much less and much, have a much smaller impact than if we just allow this thing to burn down.
Scale up partnerships with private enterprise and with the states. I wonder, Holly, if you showed pictures to people wandering around, you showed them a picture of a forest where you can throw a frisbee from one tree to another, and then a forest where that's impossible. And I think they'd pick the one where you can't throw the frisbee as the healthy one, wouldn't they? They wouldn't understand frisbee throwing in forests.
I think that's right, and it's funny, John, because 20 years ago, we actually did a picture book sort of forests and healthy forests and non-healthy forests and what they look like, and when we started doing that, I didn't get it, right? I'm like, no, that's the healthy forest. They're like, no, that's the non-healthy forest. That's the overly dense forest. That's the one that's dying and that has increased mortality. So I had to train myself, and so for the past 20 years, we've been looking at these ideas, and more people are beginning to understand what that healthy forest looks like, and that's helpful. I think we also need to be a little bit careful about using the term healthy forest and what that means, because, again, we as humans define what healthy is and what we want from our forest, and we don't all always agree on that. So when I'm talking about a healthy forest, I'm thinking about a forest that we're increasing the resiliency of that forest. We're doing some restoration so we have good wildlife habitat, we have good recreation opportunity, and we've really reduced the risk of a severe wildfire.
Longer-term contracts. You mentioned that several times during the course of the presentation here. What do you mean by longer-term? Why are they limited now for any of these services?
Well, the Forest Service has a number of different types of contracts and negotiations and contractual arrangements that they can get into to both, you know, provide ecosystem services and different types of services, you know, including, you know, putting culverts and roads in, selling timber, et cetera. And typically they are restricted to, 3, 5, 10 years. We have a few stewardship contracts that now can actually go up to 20 years if we're looking at restoration type contracts. But oftentimes that's still a little bit too short if we're actually asking somebody to invest in some infrastructure. If we need a processing plant or a mill in a region, that's millions and millions of dollars that's going to be paid back or get the return on that investment over 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So the Forest Service only being able to negotiate in these shorter term contracts is limiting the ability of some of these private investors to be willing to actually invest. So what we would like to see is the Forest Service to be able to provide a little more certainty that they're actually going to see this restoration project through and that they're going to continue to provide some of the forest products and the stuff that's within the forest that needs to be removed over a longer period of time so that the private sector is willing to invest in this. And it doesn't have to be a guarantee that they're going to get it for the next 20 years, but if the Forest Service is able to actually be in a contractual arrangement and cost share for that time period, then it provides a little bit more certainty and reduces the risk for the private sector. So it increases the willingness of the private sector to invest in some of the infrastructure that we need to add value to some of the small diameter materials that need to be pulled out of the forest.
Wood. Everybody wants wood. The puzzle I run into in Holly's presentation is there's limitations on shipping wood overseas. Where's that from? Whose good idea was the idea you can't sell wood to Europe?
We actually have had bans on wood since like way back into the 1960s, and that's a ban on export logs. And if you go back even to the day when I was doing my master's thesis many years ago, we saw that the state of Washington was banning export logs to Japan because the idea was that we would create more jobs by producing by adding value to those products here, by processing it into 2x4s and other things here in the United States rather than shipping those raw logs overseas. One of the things that we actually saw, though, was that Japan and other countries oftentimes have different metrics for the types of logs that they want. They're different sizes than our mills are set up to cut. So instead of providing us more jobs here, we actually just lost the sales. And those types of export restrictions continue to this day. And again, it's just sort of that long restriction that has some special interest group that says, no, we shouldn't be selling these logs. But at the end of the day, if the market overseas is better than the market here, and what we're trying to do is get this stuff out and get a return on it, then we ought to just open those markets up and allow them to sell. In today's world, it seems like we don't have quite enough supply here in the United States of 2x4s and whatnot, building products. So we might actually see better value right here, but why not allow that competition so that we can actually get the highest value from those logs?
You need private partnership. Won't you attract milling capacity? You say it's uneven in the country, milling capacity. Won't you attract it if you permit those mills to sell overseas unfinished logs? Doesn't that help everybody, the forest and the profit?
Absolutely. You know, trade is a win-win deal, and we are all for voluntary trade and really believe that we should get rid of some of those export restrictions so that we allow for those logs and products to be traded in an open market.
We have a minute, Holly. Did I say correctly that milling capacity is uneven throughout the country?
Yes, milling capacity definitely is uneven throughout the country.
And because of that, you have – well, you emphasize the Vagan Brothers Lumber of Washington State have a 10-year contract, and what we need is more of those 10 and 20 and 30-year contracts. That would help the forest.
That would help the forest. And Vagan Brothers has done some really, really interesting things. They have actually bid on a project where they helped pay for the NEPA because they realized that there was great value in the forest. And this was actually for some commercial timber harvest. And they were willing to help move this thing forward so they could actually tap into some of that. And they both have milling infrastructure for large diameter wood. And they also have milling infrastructure for small diameter wood that they've invested in as we're seeing more and more small diameter timbers come out of the forest.
Fix America's forest reforms to restore national forests and tackle the wildfire crisis. Holly Fretwell, Jonathan Wood. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show.
Christina Lake Cannabis is using proprietary outdoor genetics to grow and harvest cannabis in Western Canada. And with a 99-acre expansion, production should increase from nearly 72,000 pounds to a harvest capacity of over 194,000 pounds of high-quality, refined cannabis to extract exceptional THC and CBD oils. This cannabis highlight has been brought to you by Christina Lake Cannabis, U.S. trading symbol CLCFF, and in Canada CLC. ChristinaLakeCannabis.com.
The proceeding may contain forward-looking statements which may not be realized.